Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There are Republican primaries again tomorrow. Yeah, they're still going on. New York, where we are today, is the big one. Not so much for the delegates anymore, but for what Wall Street can tell us about this fall's election. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 23rd of April. I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us. We're in New York City today. There is a Republican primary here tomorrow in four other states as well. And there's no real doubt about the results. You can't say the name Mitt Romney anymore without adding presumptive nominee in front of it. But this whole thing isn't really about the primaries anymore, is it? It's a national election now about what's really going to matter in November, about what we call the real economy. And there's no better place to talk about that than New York City circa spring 2012, because the economics of this election were shaped here 4 years ago by Wall Street and subprime loans and mortgage-backed securities. The defining slogans of the past 4 years came from here: too big to fail, and we are the 99%. So today, a story throughout the program, three scenes around New York City from the past 4 years at the center of the financial universe. We begin in Midtown Manhattan in the company of our bureau chief, Heidi Moore, not far from where the financial crisis started. New York in the rain, baby.
I know.
Honestly, it's kind of dismal.
It's pretty sad, but check out the cloud patterns.
I know, it's actually very cool because you cannot see the tops of some of these buildings.
Yeah, and you'll see this whole stretch of Park Avenue is the new Wall Street, right? So all up and down here,
yeah.
This is where all the financial firms are, the private equity firms, an increasing number of hedge funds. All the banks are clustered within maybe an 8-block radius of here, all the really big banks except for Goldman Sachs. And that's a big change.
Heidi, corner 49th and 7th. But why, right? I mean, it's Barclays.
Exactly. Well, 4 years ago, this wasn't Barclays. This was Lehman Brothers, and these screens were not this brilliant blue, but they were the Hunter Green. That was the Lehman logo. Right in front of us, as you can see, there is a line of town cars prepared to take bankers to meetings.
Oh, yeah.
Where they can earn more money or make more profits, whichever way you want to see it. And this is probably not just the corner of a street, but the corner on which the financial system turned, if you'll forgive the metaphor.
That's a great line, right? Remind me where we were 4 years ago this spring, right? Bear Stearns had just gone under.
Yeah. Bear Stearns had fallen apart just a month before this, in March 2008. A lot of people in finance were confused. They were wondering what was happening to the financial system. Banks weren't lending to each other as much. Everyone was pulling in the reins and really worried about the future and trying to put a good face on it.
Every time I talked to somebody back then, we'd have them on the show and I'd say, so how long is this going to last? And they say, 6 months. And here we are still talking about this.
It's true. We're still talking about it because the problems that arose from the financial crisis are the kind that you just don't solve in 6 months. And I think what you heard back then was the level of denial that we still see in the financial system to some extent, which is how deeply the system needs to be restructured. And people didn't know back in 2008, and arguably they still don't know in 2012, how interconnected a lot of banks are and how much trouble they could potentially be in if just one more tips over like Lehman Brothers did in 2008.
You know, it occurs to me that a lot of the stuff we're talking about in this election, that people are talking about in this election, the decisions that got us here were made 4 years ago in buildings like this one.
That's right. And it's the struggle since then has been of the financial system, of the populace, of almost everyone else in America to get Wall Street to realize that. You know, I mean, if you look at New York, if you look at this street right now, you see men in the most finely woven suits possible.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because it's almost like, not that it didn't happen, but people here don't acknowledge that it happened.
I think we've heard a lot about the 99% and the 1%. And that's not just true of the economy at large. And it's certainly true in New York State, which has the highest income disparity of almost any right. state in the union. But it's also true of Wall Street. We have a 99% and a 1%, well, maybe an 80% and a 20% on Wall Street, too. We have office workers, and then we have the people who make the decisions, who make millions of dollars a year. And by no means do they march to the same beat.
Next up, Zuccotti Park. We're obviously not the first to use New York City as a convenient narrative device, because that's how you tell stories, right? You find characters and places, you mix them together, you see what happens. Playwright and actress Anna Deavere Smith does that, but she does it a little bit differently. She doesn't so much write her dialogue as she transcribes it. She talks to real people about real events and acts those events out on a stage herself. Events from the Los Angeles riots and her play Twilight Los Angeles to the debate over healthcare and her latest work. It's called Let Me Down Easy.
My life's work has been to see if I could become America by interviewing the people, absorbing their words. And having decided to do that in an era of what I would call identity politics, where, you know, people would tell most artists, you know, write about what you know, write about what you are, I thought that was going to be a spiritual dead end. And I decided to do another thing and to make it authentic by going word for word and not even venturing to suppose what, for example, a cowboy might sound like. I thought I would get to know one, and one of my dearest friends and person that I perform as a right-wing Republican rodeo bull rider.
I'm so glad you brought up that bull rider. It's from your most recent play, Let Me Down Easy,
yeah,
which is about healthcare. And I wonder if I could ask you literally on the spur of the moment, just to give me a little bit of him, and I'll tell you why I want to hear him after you do it.
Something that he would say is, you know, a lot of people ride out of confidence. I ride them out of determination. Confidence kind of like you've been on that bull before, you know you can ride him, but determination is like, I mean, you're going to hang on that bull. Even if you're riding upside down, you're going to hang on that bull till your head hits the back of the dirt.
And he rides, and he gets a ruptured kidney, and he goes to the hospital, and he's got to pay a $1,200 bill.
Well, he's pleased about that $1,200 bill because it's a flat rate. And he actually ends up giving the most progressive message of the play, ironically, because he calls for a flat rate. And he doesn't understand why, in our current medical system, you pay thing by thing.
Let Me Down Easy opened plus or minus 4 years ago, right? Right, 2008, 2009?
Something like that. Yeah, that's right. Mm.
Which was the time of the last presidential election. And it's interesting now we've had this debate in this country over health care, and it's been divisive, and it still is. Are we closer, do you think, to figuring out what we want out of our society?
Well, no, because, you know, we have a big election in front of us. It's not a full-fledged movement. I think some of the movements that we've had in the past, civil rights movement, women's movement, movements around gender and sexuality, these are things that happen inside and outside of the realm of politics, so that, you know, they happen in schools, they happen in bars, they happen on television, they happen through comedy. That hasn't happened yet in healthcare. One of my theories is that the best movements, the movements that, you know, where there's parties, I don't mean like Republicans and Democrats, but where there's, you know, music and dance and booze.
The good
those
kind
are
of parties,
the most
yeah.
successful cultural movement that excites younger people. And younger people are to some extent outside of this because they're the ones who don't get sick as often, you know, unless something really unfortunate happens to them. And they may not even be thinking about how am I going to take care of myself or even my mother, because they're not old enough to have parents who are sick yet.
But I wonder if now, instead of identity politics, we're thinking more in this country along the lines of identity economics, what with the Occupy movement and the 99% and income inequality that is big and growing.
Oh, yeah, that's really interesting. I think you're right. I haven't thought about it that way. New idea for me.
There you go. Is there fodder for you, just because I'd love to see it? I mean, I would pay money to see you do the financial crisis, to interview Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan Chase and Ben Bernanke and put them on stage in some contextual thing.
Do you think they would let me do that?
I don't know. Come on. You got to talk to Lance Armstrong and Lauren Hutton and Daryl Gates, the former police chief of L.A. I mean, people talk to you.
You know, maybe. You know, let's see how bad it gets. Daryl Gates, who people, you know, blame the riot on him, he agreed he made a mistake. And so,
oh, yeah,
for that,
you see, you're never going to get bankers to admit they made a mistake, right, Jamie?
I don't know. Yeah. That I don't know. I don't know. I am truly, truly very interested in the other person. It's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. And that why not use this extraordinary magical skill called acting to embody the people with whom I have differences and to leave judgment to people who do it better than me, lawyers, people in courts of law. I'm not that great at that.
Anna Deavere Smith, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Newton's third law tells us that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. That's true in economics as it is in the hard sciences. It's just that those economic reactions tend to take a little while to play out. After Lehman and the financial crisis, something was bound to happen. And that gets us to Act Two of my Manhattan walkabout this morning with Heidi Moore. Zuccotti Park, what used to be Occupy Wall Street. There's still lots of police and surveillance equipment down there. But if you hadn't known what was there, you'd never have known.
This vast moonscape of granite, this empty plaza that's full of commuters now, used to be a tent city full of protesters against the financial system. Signs, what seemed like a budding revolution almost, and now it is so gone that there aren't even police here. There aren't even barricades because no one would even dare come here and try to protest again. And that might be a sad little statement on a movement that changed almost everything in our perception of Wall Street.
As you said, there's nothing here now, but Occupy didn't get what it wanted.
What they got was a little bit more intangible. I think if you talk to people on Wall Street, what Occupy accomplished is that it brought income inequality to the forefront of the national conversation. It made a big fuss about what's wrong with the financial system, whereas before, they might have argued, and other people might have argued, that, you know, the country was full of passive sheep that would just take whatever banks would give them. And here you had the beginning of a movement. Maybe it was diffused, but it got the ball. It didn't even get the ball rolling because the ball had never rolled in the first place.
Well, and that's where we are now, right? You had Occupy on one side, not happy with the economics and the finances in this country. And for a totally different reason, you got the Tea Party on the other side, equally unhappy with the economics of this country, right? And now that's what we're talking about this fall.
That's right. I don't know if you saw this cartoon. It ran in a newspaper a while back, but it showed Occupy Wall Street protesting in front of a bank, and it showed the Tea Party protesting in front of the government. And if you panned up a few floors, it was the same building.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
They're interconnected. Wall Street and the government are interconnected. And what Occupy Wall Street was started to do was to point that out.
But Heidi, here's the thing, right? We're at Occupy Wall Street, and yet there is no Occupy Wall Street. So the question is, did anything change?
A lot, unfortunately, has not changed, right? So little things have, like bank fees. You saw people protesting about that and banks rolling them back. But the larger scale of the financial system, it's still too big to fail. Regulation is still not in place. The connection of the economy to the financial markets is something that will remain questionable until, unfortunately, we see in another crisis just how deep we're in it.
Coming up, next stop, Broadway and 48th.
We're here because Morgan Stanley is a survivor of the financial crisis, and it's an indication of how far we've come and how far we haven't.
But first, let's do the numbers. Worries about political turmoil in Europe slammed the markets today. As you might have heard, the Dow Industrials lost 0.75%, 102 points, closed at 12,927. The NASDAQ gave back 1%, 30 points, 2970. The S&P 500 erased 0.8%, 11 points, 1366 the number. Walmart got creamed today after a report in the New York Times detailed an alleged bribery scandal and cover-up in its Mexican unit. Shares in the discount retailer sank more than 4.5%. On the financial front, Morgan Stanley threw off 2.8%. Bank of America gave back more than 2%. Today, Facebook said in a regulatory filing today that its first quarter earnings fell 12%. You might want to keep that in mind when the social network begins offering stock next month. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for March. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. And President Obama honors the National Teacher of the Year at the White House. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM in New York City. Today, I'm Kai Rizdal. As if the economics of the federal deficit weren't enough, the states now have a $1 trillion problem of their own. That's the shortfall that state-run retirement systems are said to be facing over the next 30 years. Some, including New York, where we are today, are making changes to those pension plans to fill the funding gap, which has public workers claiming the states are breaking a $1 trillion promise.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's David Gura reports now on the changes facing one group of middle-class Americans and why benefits for public workers have become so political.
English teacher Ray Pultinas has taught at a big high school in the Bronx for 22 years now, and he says he's got three more left.
I'm ready to retire. Not that I'm talking about it all the time, but I feel I've done my time.
After college, Pultinas tried acting, but that didn't work out. Teaching, he says, was a way to contribute to society. Pultinas teaches an elective class on activism, and he started a community garden at DeWitt Clinton High School. But over the years, his job has changed. He's trying to teach American literature to students who are reading at 5, sometimes 6 grade levels below where they should be. And his school is way overcrowded.
It's not the way high school used to be.
When Pultinas retires early at 55, he'll get what's called a defined benefit pension, a check in the mail every month for the rest of his life. That's what he signed up for.
We didn't have the expectation of getting a high salary, but we did have the expectation of having a stable job.
And a secure retirement. He makes just over $90,000 a year. He and his wife rent an apartment in a middle-class neighborhood in the Bronx. They have 2 kids. Still, Pultinas says, in New York City, they're living paycheck to paycheck, and he's looking forward to moving somewhere with a lower cost of living. For decades, public sector jobs like teaching were considered good jobs, but they don't guarantee the kind of stability they used to. Lee Adler teaches at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations, and he says pension reform has raised a big question.
To whom should the government be responsible? To its employees? To its citizens?
The private sector began to answer that question years ago. Responsibility has shifted away from employers. These days, most workers in the private sector won't get the kind of retirement benefits Ray will. They're putting money in 401ks. So when it comes to retirement, Adler says public sector workers are getting a lot less sympathy.
And I think average folks, especially folks that aren't in unions, citizens that aren't in unions, have every right in the world to ask and wonder about this whole process.
Many state-run retirement systems have been underfunded, but Adler says New York's is not one of them. It's actually in pretty good shape. But many politicians, including New York's Democratic governor, ran on a platform of pension reform, on fiscal responsibility. So the debate over pension reform in New York State was political and acrimonious. It pitted lawmakers against each other and against unions. And high school teacher Ray Pultina says that fight changed how public sector workers are perceived here.
We're looked upon as kind of people who are somehow abusing the system.
If he were starting his teaching career today, Pultinas would have to contribute more money to his retirement plan, and he'd have to retire years later. The unions and other opponents of pension reform promised to use their influence in the next election. They argue it's not their fault states mismanaged retirement systems, and they're worried it's going to get harder for the public sector to attract top talent and to keep it.
Stay 2 more minutes.
Bethany Weisberger teaches environmental science at Brooklyn Community Arts and Media High School. She said she got a job with the New York City Department of Education right after college.
Yeah, I guess I didn't expect that I would be a teacher, and I definitely didn't expect I would still be a teacher.
In New York City, some 50% of teachers quit after 5 years. Weisberger has been teaching for 9 now. She says that while good benefits aren't the only reason she's stuck with the job, it's one of them. And Weisberger says that if she stays in the profession, she deserves a pension.
I don't know if it's a reward, but we should support teachers or, you know, any sort of service jobs that are. I mean, it's a public school. It's a public service.
And so for Weisberger, the debate over pension reform isn't just about the government keeping its promises to teachers like her. It's about the value of public sector workers.
David Gurr is in the studio with me out here in New York City. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
So you said New York State's pension fund is actually doing all right.
Yeah, so the Pew Center on the States has actually crunched the data, and when you look ahead 30 years, New York State is actually 101% funded. So much better than other states like West Virginia or Illinois, which are just over half funded.
Right.
New York State's actually in pretty good shape.
101%, more than what they need.
Right, and so that's led some people to say that maybe this latest round of pension reforms in New York State was more politically motivated than fiscally motivated.
What was it, though, that New York did that got it to be in such a good place and other states maybe didn't?
Basically, when it made promises to its workers, it made provisions in the budget to pay for them or to pay for them in the future. Other states didn't do that, and you'll remember that in the 90s we had some pretty good times. The markets were doing well.
Yeah.
Many states and municipalities just stopped contributing to these plans altogether. Obviously, events intervened, and now they're having to pay for it.
Right. What happens now, then? I mean, if they haven't made the preparations and they've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of people?
Well, it varies state by state. Some states are able to make really big changes. Other states can make smaller ones, maybe raising the retirement age for new employees. This is something that states are going to be wrestling with over these next couple of years, because if they don't, situation's only going to get worse and worse, Kai.
Yeah. David Gurra and pension reform. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
It's about 4.5 miles from Zuccotti Park and all the symbolism of what happened down at the south end of Manhattan to the reality of where Wall Street actually is today. It's in Midtown, in the big banks, where we arrive at Act 3 of our story, the final stop.
This is Broadway and 48th Street. Morgan Stanley's right there, but why are we here?
We're here because Morgan Stanley is a survivor of the financial crisis, and we like to see survivors, but also it's an indication of how far we've come and how far we haven't. Morgan Stanley is bigger. A lot of banks are bigger. In fact, they're 25% bigger. And there's a lot more concentration of the financial system in a fewer number of hands, which is the opposite of what we wanted.
But I thought we had all that fixed, right? Dodd-Frank and financial reform and the things that Washington has been talking about for 4 years now.
Well, if Washington delivered the way that it talked, maybe we'd be in a better situation right now. But, you know, this is not just a giant skyscraper. It is a political football. And it's a way to run a campaign to talk about the economy and the financial markets. And what we've learned is that the financial markets, banks like Morgan Stanley, banks like Barclays, Goldman Sachs, have a lot more control over the economy that the rest of us live through than ever before.
New York's a big place. So there are, of course, plenty of buildings or street corners we could have used to tell the economic story of the past 4 years. Thing is, what regular people talk about when they talk about the economy isn't usually Wall Street. It's getting a job or
saving money, paying for basics like gas and food, or dealing with student loan debt. That's the economy this election is going to be about.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, enough from us about the real economy in the election. A moment now for some voices of New Yorkers and what they think. We start with Dr. Vish Tanik and his daughter.
We're selling Girl Scout cookies.
Selling Girl Scout cookies at an incredibly well-trafficked stoop.
You have to like lemon.
I do. Okay, I can only do three. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm in plastic surgery, reconstructive plastic surgery, so most of it's necessary. I don't really do cosmetic surgery, but if you talk to cosmetic surgeons, it was a huge drop-off, like almost immediately. And even though it's come back to some degree, people are certainly doing less than they used to do. I think that it's just generally so expensive to live in this city that if you're able to live here, you're probably relatively less affected than the majority of people in the country. Otherwise, you probably couldn't or wouldn't live here anymore. So, yeah, I think we're quite skewed.
My name is Susan Pierce, and I am a long, long time resident of Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, New York. Right now, we're doing this flea market for the church where we can sell things to help us with repairs and renovations.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
We have a prayer box, and we've experienced a number of prayer requests asking for employment opportunities, and it seems like we've gotten more than what we ever had before.
Thank you, and God bless you. Have a good week.
My name is Jim Castaldo. I'm walking my dog in the middle of Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Boobersh wants to be on the radio, too. For me, the economy has been a little bit difficult because I teach English to foreigners, and consequently, I depend on immigrants. But immigrants have stopped coming to the States, given the fact that they can find jobs abroad more easily in some situations, and in others, jobs here are too difficult to find. Creating jobs is hell. It's not an easy thing to do for any president, you know, and creating jobs is trying to create an atmosphere in which people will be encouraged to hire. And that atmosphere hasn't been created by either President Obama or Romney from the point of what he's talked about. So I'm kind of negative on both on that one. Every walk I got to watch out. I've always voted, but this time I wonder. I'm sorry, guys. Well, that's a Brooklyn scene, okay? We can't avoid that.
Ann Hepperman helped produce that piece for us. Coming up on Friday, the financial crisis from the top down, a sit-down interview with Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. All right, we got to go. That's it. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Michael Rayfield engineered the broadcast for us today. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Soul the Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Soul the Story are available now.